Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. The hotline is brought to you by Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. The first call, the only call. Welcome back to the show here. Sorry, I'm just reading some text that came into the Dunbar Lumber.
I like
text.
The guy we'll suggested get into it at some we point. Tier Canucks players based on their Scrabble word score.
That's what I was just reading.
Yeah, I like that.
Well, I actually think, okay, so
Zadorov, I think, would rank highly.
The segment?
Kuzmenko.
Yes, for sure. Zadorov has got to be up there, yeah. Mikheyev.
If they get Jack Eye from...
Oof, that's a killer. That's number one.
It's got a
the J?
An X, an E, H, yeah. An E.
K.
Dolly Wall's worst nightmare.
Yeah. No, he nailed it.
It
he
did.
Nailed it.
He
I
just couldn't
shocked.
Believe. To do research. He named it, but he couldn't believe that he did. He was like, this can't possibly be right. Jack Eye?
A Jack Eye.
Like, what am I saying? How is this right? What I want to do...
He'd be calling him Xerox within a minute.
Yeah, the segment that I want to do is... So yesterday after the show, I don't know in what context, but we started talking about quarterbacks in the NFL. Specifically Brock Purdy, I guess. And your contention that Brock Purdy is good.
Well, no, my contention is that Brock
That's
Purdy...
That's fine. I'm not arguing with that.
No, my contention is that Brock Purdy is perfectly average.
Yeah. And
I think Brock Purdy is the... The problem is that... So... In the United States, anyway, Brock Purdy is like the MVP of sports talk.
Yes.
Because there's like a school of folks who stunt about Brock Purdy being elite, 20-6 as a starter, you know, 20-5, with the exception of that Eagles game where he got hurt right away. Like, wow, it's 20-2 so long as he's got Debo and Williams, the offensive lineman. Like, you know, this guy's one of the best. He's just a winner. How do you argue with wins? Blah, blah, blah. And then you've got the other people who are like, every game he throws three balls that should be picked, including a 51-yard reception.
Yeah.
Like, watch the games.
And he also has the best collection of skill players in the league and a great offensive-minded coach.
Best collection of skill players since the greatest show on turf, Rams, right? And because there's such high highs and such low lows, I think everyone's ignoring that it's like this guy's basically a more mobile iteration of Goff to a you know, if you've got the infrastructure, you're fine. He's good enough, but you know, I don't think he's winning you games the way one of the guys is.
He's 2024 Mark Sanchez.
No,
he's better than that,
because Mark Sanchez first 2 years very similar.
Stop it, Jets content over here.
Wow, that's
anyway,
such a bad take.
So we were having this discussion and I brought up Kirk
Brutal.
Cousins.
Mark Sanchez is like rich man's Tim Tebow.
Go look at the first years. You'll be surprised.
No, I won't.
I won't be surprised. I brought up Kirk Cousins, and your reaction was, Kirk Cousins is sick.
Yeah.
And I took exception to that. I was like, okay, yeah. I'm not going to say Kirk Cousins is bad, but you cannot say Kirk Cousins is sick. That is a bridge too far for me.
Kirko rocks, dude.
He's a decent quarterback, but he's not sick.
His tweets are fire.
And so
he's
then,
league average.
And then we had
no, he's no, better
he's above,
than average.
He's above average. And then we had a debate about, we just kind of went through like all the quarterbacks
what's
in the NFL.
Tier?
Are they sick
who's
or not?
Who's the worst quarterback you
who's
can call
the,
sick?
Yeah, who's the worst quarterback in the league?
And
you, can
and
call
you
sick?
Decided it was Dak, and I decided it was Cousins.
Yeah, I said Dak was the dividing line. If you're worse than Dak,
you
can't be sick. You can't be sick. So I think this is what we should do at some point is just get people to text
what's the sick,
hockey players.
What's the sick Mendoza line for hockey players?
Yeah. Who do you have to be better than to qualify as sick?
This is the problem, though. Like, Nils Höglander plays on the Canucks' fourth line. Nils Höglander is sick.
Okay, here's the thing. So partly it's talent. There's different ways you can get to be sick.
Well, because that's what we were discussing. We're like,
because like, Justin
Fields
is sick, even though he's a below-average quarterback. But because he can do sick things. Now, see, this is a philosophical debate, right? It's like, if you do one selfish thing, are you selfish or did you just do a selfish thing? You know what I mean? Is Justin Fields sick or can he just do sick things on the football field?
Oh, man. Now we're getting into like deep epistemological arguments here, man. And you know what? When it comes to oncology, I just can't.
I'm just going to let that one sit
yeah,
there.
That, me too.
But anyways, you're right, because you can be a young, exciting player and be sick, or you can just be really good and be sick. Those are like the two avenues.
Sure.
But
anyway, Point is, what's the Mendoza line for hockey players? I don't know.
If a hockey player, you think of a hockey player that's right on the borderline, right on the fence for being sick or not. Text in and we'll try to decide if he is in fact sick. This is the most like elder millennial segment of ours, by the way, because I don't think young people say sick anymore. That's like definitely a...
No, they're too busy saying what's up.
An early 2000s high school thing.
They're too busy saying what's up, man.
Anyways, it is Canucks talk here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Now, we touched on it a little bit in the first segment when we were talking about the Nikita Zadorov thing, you know, all the different players who they could potentially use to clear up cap space. You have you and Harmon have up at the Athletic your second part of the Canucks 2024 trade tiers who could move at the NHL trade deadline. And of course, as you mentioned, there's some, you know, Tyler Myers, Connor Garland names who are contributing in a really meaningful way to the Canucks right now that would only be considered, as you say, unless there's a blockbuster. But I did want to spend a little bit of time focusing on some of the more kind of realistic chips that they could play, right? And, you know, that's, of course, Nils Höglander, which I think would have to be a really significant move given the value he's bringing to the team, but also other prospects. You know, we've talked so much about Volander and Jonathan Lekaramäki and the value they would have. One of the names that you brought up in the piece that we haven't really talked about is Atu Ratu. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago where Atu Ratu was the prospect in the classic, you know, pick, player, and prospect formulation that the Islanders used to land Bo Horvat, a really, really good player in his prime, pending UFA, yes, but that they signed to an extension. Like, that's a pretty valuable asset, or he was a pretty valuable asset in that trade for the Canucks. And it feels like we don't really talk about him as a potential trade chip right now for the Canucks, but where do you see his value at going into to trade season?
Well, this is where your mileage will vary greatly trade chip. And this is sort of where I think the discussion dovetails on Kuzmenko as well, right? Like, you see so many trade packages coming into our inbox, for example, and a reminder, if you want us to tell you that your trades suck, feel free to text them into the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line, and we'll do that tomorrow. But the, you know, the thing to remember about guys like Ratu is that your mileage is going to vary significantly based on the team, right? What teams evaluating and think, right? Are there teams in the league that would see Atu Ratu as like a, you know, potential buy low, right? Given that last year he was trending to be like a really high-end prospect, was clearly the number one prospect in the New York Islanders system on the day the Canucks acquired him. And yet this year has sort of been quiet in the American League, right? He's still just 21. The fact that he's playing like a regular shift, the fact that he's a regular for the Abbotsford Canucks is still a pretty good sign. You know, he's not fallen beneath a level of production at his age where you'd say, hey, he's unlikely to be a top six caliber forward in the future. Unfortunately, a guy like Podkolzin kind of has. You know, like, to be a 23-year-old with that level of draft pedigree, a 14-goal NHL season under your belt, and not be dominant in the AHL, like, that tends to be a sign that, not that he's not going to be an impactful NHL player, but that, like, his chances of being a top six guy are certainly reduced given his production, you know, in this particular season. So, you know, it's an interesting one to evaluate. Are there teams that would see the size, the fact that he's stuck at center, right? That was one thing, like, when the Canucks acquired him,
is
remember?
Is he actually a center? Yeah.
Yeah, there was some industry concern. Is he an actual center? Does he have the foot speed to stay there? The fact that he's stuck at center, is playing a regular shift, has been productive, you know, to the tune of what, like 0.6 something points per game at 21 in the American League. Like, that's all good stuff. And I think that would still give him some value, but I don't think many teams would be like asking for him first. You know what I mean? Like, I think if you're trading one of the higher profile rentals, certainly if you're trading, you know, a Gensel quality piece, like, I think Ratu's well down your list of priority targets from the Canucks, you know, certainly carrying less value than their 2024 first, for example.
This, you mentioned Podkolzin here. This question comes in. Hey guys, what about Podkolzin? I hear no talk of him. Would he be a good asset to trade away? Podkolzin is interesting because you're right. I mean, at this stage, you know what? This is like his draft plus five season. Hasn't clicked as an everyday NHL player and, you know, performing well at the AHL level. I know he had a good spate of games recently, but again, not like best player in the league material or anything like that. Not lighting the league on fire. I wonder if Podkolzin is almost at this point, because of that distressed value being, you know, distressed value situation a little bit, is more valuable to hold on to for the Canucks than to use as a trade asset, right? Like, could there be a situation where Podkolzin comes up and contributes in the bottom six, even in the playoffs for the Canucks this year? Like, yeah. I could absolutely see that. You know what I mean? Where, and is that more valuable? Is the chances of that more valuable? Having him as depth that you feel good about, that's familiar with the team, familiar with the system, is that more valuable than he would be as a trade asset at this point?
Maybe. Maybe. I mean, you know, we're at the point now where he's played 61 AHL games,
mm-hmm.
right? At the ages of sort of 20, 21. And he's got 43 total points, which is above that sort of 0.7 mark that, just as a shorthand barometer, like, I want to see a guy ages 22, 23 be at least 0.7 in the American League if they're going to have top nine potential. You're always going to get outliers, right? You're always going to get. But the thing about the outlier guys is there's still evidence of them being an outlier right off the hop. So, like, let me give you an example. Zach Hyman at the age of 23, right, was like 0.6-ish points per game in his rookie American League season, okay? But the reason he's an outlier is he also played 16 games in the NHL. So he was good enough at things not picked up by the data, stats.
Yeah.
That he earned a promotion and never went back, right? That's the sort of, like, data point that you want to see from an outlier. He forced their hand. I do think the reason, like, Linus Karlsson's come up is that the organization's far more comfortable with Linus Karlsson hanging out in the press box
100%.
On a game night than Vasily Podkolzin, who obviously they're a little more focused on his development. I think the thing to remember about Podkolzin is he's still young enough and his profile is still rare enough given his size, right? Given his motor, that I still think there'd be value there. Like, there would probably be a few teams that would value him above Vancouver's 2024 first round pick still, but I don't think that would be like a consensus opinion necessarily. You know, some teams would, some teams wouldn't. Depends how you rate the player. But yeah, I mean, he's a decent trade chip, and I definitely, like, on the one hand, you're right. There's an opportunity here for the Canucks to hold, right? A piece who might be at a low ebb of their value. On the other side of it, though, you do have to consider with a guy who has reached his age and stage, like, that you're running out of runway where there's a team that would ever value him above a first round pick.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, the guy, the just a guy, like the Jag moment is coming fast for a player like Podkolzin, particularly because he will require waivers beginning next season. Right? So his entry level deal will expire and he will require waivers. In either 42 NHL games played, which he can't hit this year. So next year he becomes waiver eligible. And at that point, like, he has to be on your team, or, you know, Vegas is claiming him.
Yeah, somebody's
Vegas or Florida or, like, somebody that likes to work the wire will take that look. So that's sort of where you're approaching. On the one hand, I still think there's value because of the rarity of his profile. On the other, you really might be coming up to that moment. And we talked about this, like, the summer of Jack Rathbone signed. We talked about this ad nauseum, right?
Yeah.
Like, this might be your last chance to get value for Jack Rathbone. Club holds him, ends up trading him for Mark Friedman, right? This might be your, like, there's a chance that this is a low ebb of his value, but there's also a chance that his value is, like, on an inexorable slide.
Yeah.
And this is your last chance to monetize it.
Inexorable. No? Inexorable?
Yeah, excuse me.
I was just checking. It's one of those words that you read a lot but don't hear a lot. Totally. You know what I mean? You're like, is this right?
I don't know why it came into
that
my...
is a good
Who
point,
reads
though.
That a lot?
I don't. I do. Read a book. Lot? Read a book once or twice in your life, Dom.
No.
I simply will not.
So the American we're facing an American versus British issue. Inexorable.
Yeah.
The way I said it was the American. The way you said it
was the British.
Is the British.
Very good.
Yeah. So we're both right.
There we go.
Yay!
The best result possible. That's a good point about the waiver eligibility.
Dom is so exhausted by our program today.
That's the nerdiest moment in the history of the show.
Are you kidding me? Drance referenced Infinite Jest on the show a week ago.
And then Jamie during the break was like, how did you know I was reading that?
I literally have it in my backpack right now. I was like, what?
Oh, that's funny. My other car is Infinite Jest.
You guys are too much.
My other car.
I was just saying, if you're going to call
car is a pinch and
if you're going to call something the nerdiest moment on the show, like you got to know that's a high bar to clear on this show.
I dropped an Ents reference in the program yesterday.
You did.
Like, yeah, but a lot of people know Lord of the Rings.
That's true.
People don't know an Inexorable.
It's a good point, though, about Pod Colson and the waiver eligibility and that impact. Like, because I was coming at this as, you know, is he at a low point in his value? But you're right. The value could fall off a cliff if he doesn't take that next step and be ready to stick in your lineup. I think the other, like, this is such a good indicator of how far the Canucks have come as a team and how different their position is this year, right? Because I think even if they were like a bubble playoff team this year or, you know, holding down one of the wild card spots right now, I think it would be a clear hold, right? Hey, young talent, keep him. You're probably not going to win the cup anyways this year. Just see what he can do for you next year and hope he's ready to step in. Now, when you're this good, you have to be at least willing to consider moving these players if it's the kind of thing that's going to get the right deal done. I also just can't help but thinking, you know, people always bring up the need for cheap talent in connection with Lekkerimäki and Villander, but Pod Colson could step into your lineup next year. And again, I know there's a lot of wish casting going on. Like, we were penciling him into the lineup this year and that didn't work out. But I do think there's an opportunity for you to get that cheap value. Yeah, no, you're right. It didn't. I just wonder if that's another potential source of that cheap labor in your lineup.
Well,
right?
The other thing is if you're going to have trouble retaining a pair of bottom six guys who are at least going to score 15 and might get 20 in Lafferty and Dakota Joshua, right? Who bring real size to this forward mix in the bottom six. Like, if those are going to be hard deals to do, and I think they are, right?
Joshua one 100% is.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
Like, does the fact that you've got, you know, a player with Pod Colson's size waiting in the wings to be a cheap internal replacement, does that hold appeal? The thing to remember is this organization knows. You know, like, they know at this point more than anyone else what they're seeing from this player, right?
Yep.
They saw him at training camp. It was clear that he had zero confidence. Like, it was so clear.
Mm-hmm.
And he struggled massively, like, just massively. Wasn't even close to breaking camp with the team. Wasn't on the bubble. And they've seen him in the American League, and they'll have a really good sense of how he's tracking. Is he tracking in a way that's interesting enough that you're considering him as a possible replacement? Should you struggle to pay one of the big money guys? Or are you going to need more? Like, are you going to need to fill that gap externally? They'll know that. And that's, I'm sure, going to play a huge role. Like Jeremy Colton's evaluation, right? Probably going to play a huge role in how they ultimately decide to proceed.
It does feel, now that we talked it out a little bit, like a big inflection point, right? If you're high on Pod Colson, if you're really high as an organization, Pod Colson, probably a hold. But if you have any of those questions whatsoever, this might be the chance to get that value out of the asset. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. Send your thoughts in. Up next, we'll connect with ESPN's Ryan Clark here on the show. By the way, the iconic Coors Light Chill Train is heading to Las Vegas for the big game, and it just made a stop in Vancouver, leaving behind a trail of epic prizes. On February 1st and 2nd, from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m., look for its frozen tracks at Robson Square for a chance to win instant prizes that deliver big game day chill or the ultimate grand prize, a trip to next year's big game event. Learn more at CoorsLight.ca/thechilltrain. You want to do a train noise?
No, I'm good.
All right. More Canucks talk up next here on Sportsnet 650.
Big opinions and good bets. It's the People's Show with Bick Nizar. Be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listen to the train sounds over the ad read.
That was not planned. That was not planned.
It was planned by me.
Oh, welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com.
Jamie. We're,
yes?
Can you pass the ocean spray and the skateboard?
Very good, Dub. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Yeah, Dom had to scold Drance in the Canucks Talk group chat. Don't make the train noises.
That's very disappointing. We need to send a copy to our friends at Coors, and they don't have the choo-choo in
they,
the
we don't
raid.
Want to send them the choo-choo version.
No.
We want to send them the real version when we do that. We're Ryan Clark from ESPN is going to join us here. By the way, so we did the send us your NHL players that you're confused about whether or not they're sick. So somebody texted in Matt Barzal. Is Matt Barzal sick? I said, clearly, 100%.
Matt Barzal is so
way
sick.
Over the line. Somebody else, completely unrelated, texted in Matt Barzal is not sick. Well, I don't know what you're talking about. How do people decide that this is the dividing line? Also, like, clearly a sick player.
Clearly.
And the thing is, even if you were, like, not sold on his overall value, his style vaults him well over the line because he's exciting. He's super exciting.
I mean,
you know what I mean?
If Matt Barzal's not sick, what are we even doing here?
Yeah, then it's bad news for the rest of the league because he's an exceptionally sick player. All right. It is Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Now joining us from ESPN, he is Ryan Clark. Ryan, thanks for doing this. How are you?
Good, good. How are you two doing this afternoon?
We're doing well. We're trying to keep busy and fill the air on a Canucks bye week all-star break here, and I'd say we're doing an all right job.
The task we were born for.
Yes, exactly. The task you were born for sure. Filling dead air on the radio. What do you think about the all-star format this year, and in particular the skills competition with all the, you know, the same competitors going at it in all the events and the $1 million on the line? Do you think this is going to work to actually produce some compelling TV?
It could. The NHL is facing the same challenge every professional league is facing when it comes to an all-star competition, which is how do you put something out there that fans are really going to like? And not only like, but you're trying something different. Like, we're seeing it in the NBA, where you think about 20 years ago, the slam dunk competition, that was the centerpiece of that All-Star Saturday, and now it's switched to where the three-point competition has become that. And the dunk contest with each and every year, people keep asking, why do we keep doing this, especially when the best players don't participate in the dunk contest? You see it every year with the Pro Bowl, where you're seeing players shuffle in and out. And with the NHL, again, it's the matter of, like, how do you find a way to make this game more interesting? How do you find a way to provide a different look? You look at the different things this league has done over time. What was it, North America versus the world? Now you're doing the player draft, and you brought that back. So, again, it's just trying to see if something can work, if something can materialize. But as we saw last year with South Florida, like, it was about getting players engaged. And if you're the league, you're trying to only get players engaged with fans engaged as well.
Ryan, I've always believed that All-Star games are essentially as interesting as the sport is safe to compete in, right? So, like, baseball, you know, it's a game almost more than it is an athletic competition. No hitting. I always think that that's the best All-Star game as a result, and then basketball second, and then you get to the NHL and the Pro Bowl, and it's like, oh, boy, it's hard to manufacture anything like the intensity that we love in an exhibition environment like that.
It can be, just because there's so many more variables. Because, like, with the NBA, there's definitely different ways to score, and it's kind of that thought of, like, the first 2.5 quarters, it's just sort of open floor, and then when you get to that late third for the rest of the fourth, you're going to see defense. With the Pro Bowl, it's sort of anything goes. Baseball, because of the pitching and the hitting, there's all that. With the NHL, again, it's interesting because, like, for the people who say, hey, let's have a 3-2 sort of game, sure, it's something that would mimic what you would see in a regular season game, but at the same time, there are still those fans who say, it's the All-Star game. I want to see goals, goals, and goals. And then if you give them that, then you have the people who say, I want more defense. So if you look at some way, you're never really going to be able to please everybody with this. But at the same time, again, like, at least it is trying something different, which no matter the format of what you try, you're never going to please everyone. But it seems like with the NHL, it's just about, hey, can you give people the best game possible? And as for what that is, that would meet everyone. Who knows? Maybe it's 4-3, but also it's an All-Star game where you don't really expect defense to be at the forefront, considering when the initial All-Star team came out, there was, what, 2 or 3 defensemen at most? It was nothing but forwards. So that should tell you everything you need to know.
Yeah, and I mean, and the defensemen who are there, it's like Quinn Hughes and Cale Makar, like the guys who can do what they can do with the puck.
Exactly.
So we were kicking this around earlier in the show, looking at the Western Conference playoff race, and there's probably 7 teams, even with the LA Kings slide of late, who you think are probably safe to make the playoffs. And then there's a big group of teams battling for that final spot. It's St. Louis, Nashville, Arizona, Minnesota, Seattle, Calgary. Of those teams, you know, all flawed in their own way, who do you think has the best chance of claiming that final wild card spot in the West?
Whoever can find the most consistency, and at this point it is anybody's guess, because that's why these teams are in this situation. Like with the Blues, yes, they've won 5 in a row as of late, and they're tied on points with the Kings. Granted, the Kings so have played one fewer game, but at this moment in time, you would think maybe it's the Blues, and if so, it's a continuation of what we've seen this season, which is, have you been in a slow start? Have you fired your coach? What has been the result of that? Well, if you ask the Edmonton Oilers, it could be the thing that gets into the Cup final the way they're going, because they've won 16 straight. You're now seeing this happen with the St. Louis Blues, where, hey, they've now won 5 in a row, 6 of their last 10. Of course, the Minnesota Wild under Hines, there was a decent start, but we've since sort of seen a little bit of a regression, but again, they've been dealing with all sorts of issues. But at this point, you would say the Blues, the Predators are a team to keep an eye on, because when you look at Andrew Brunette teams, whether he was the interim head coach of the Florida Panthers or an assistant with the Devils last year, his teams score, and if they can continue that, it's going to keep them in the hunt. It seems like, truthfully, the most fascinating team in this whole group. There's a tie for 2. One is the Arizona Coyotes, just because going into this season with everything they did in the offseason, there was some intrigue about what they were going to do, and could this be the sort of year that season hit 80 points? And it looks like that could still happen, but again, now you're talking about what are the Coyotes going to do as they're chasing a playoff opportunity? Like, is it something where they're maybe going to try to go in, or do they think they're better off as sellers when the deadline arrives? And then the Calgary Flames, for the fact that this was the narrative going into the season with them, wasn't it? Which is, you have half this roster tied up long-term. The other half, they could be moving on after this season, so it's about gaining clarity. And here you are going into the All-Star break at 49 games, and no one really knows what the Calgary Flames are at this point. But one thing is clear, they've got to get it figured out, whether they're a team that thinks they can make a push or they're a team that's going to sell at the deadline. But then it's kind of like what we saw last year with Calgary and Nashville. Like, you make these moves at the deadline only to fall within 3 or so points short of making the playoffs, and then it leaves you wondering, could you have done something else instead?
Ryan, just to focus in on Seattle, is this boost back into the playoff picture, is it mostly Joey Decord, or are you seeing material return to form from them?
It's hard to even say return to form, just because they were so different than what they were last year. Last year, they were this team that, again, the shooting percentage was one of the best in the league. This year, it is not that. And so they've had to rely more on a two-way approach. Now, yes, having Joey Decor helps, because believe last time we had this conversation about Joey Decor, you look at his save percentages this season, he's already had some performances that have been among the best in the Kraken's 3 years. And it's also been the most consistent stretch of goaltending the Kraken have had, because even when Martin Jones was winning games for them last year, it wasn't like Martin Jones was consistently above 910, 915, 920 with a save percentage. You're getting that from Joey Decor. You're getting games that are above 900 with save percentage. You're getting consistency. And not only that, but you're getting a sense of security in net, which the Kraken haven't always had, but then you're having to rely on everyone to get contributions. And that's what makes Oliver Bjorkstrand going to the All-Star game such an embodiment of that team. It's like, if there's one player who kind of represents like what they have to do to win games, it's him, in the sense of like, when you look at his complete game, it's about working, it's about facilitating, it's about being in the corners and doing all the things you need to do to pry possession. And then once you get possession, it's you work to maintain it with the hope the end product is it's a goal. And that's exactly what Bjorkstrand has been for them this season. And so with the Kraken, it's one of those things where, because of what they did last year, there's this expectation they could get back there. But they have now shown through 49 games, this is a different team than last year.
You know, the Kraken are one of those teams that I always think teams in their situation are in such a tough spot going into the deadline, right? Because you're not all the way out of it, but you're probably not in a position to be an aggressive buyer either. And you just look at the Kraken, you know, they have pending UFAs who I'm sure would generate a lot of interest on the market. Jordan Eberle, Alex Wenberg, Justin Schultz, right? Do you have a sense of what they might try to do at the deadline given their position?
If you look at recent history, one would suggest they might try to add around the edges, but not much else, especially when you look at what the prices could be. Because when you look at Ron Francis' tenure as a general manager, he's never made a player-for-player trade. It's always been picks and players, because like even with the Daniel Sprong trade, which worked out for them, that was Marcus Johansson for draft picks and Daniel Sprong, and it turned out that Daniel Sprong ended up being one of the more consistent players that they had on the roster. But in terms of what they end up doing, Francis is in his staff, but they're going to look at a couple things. The first being, what does the long-term impact look like on the cap? The second being, are these the sort of moves that you think can sort of work not only within the short term, but in the long term, but also like, what is this going to allow them to do like going forward in terms of what can they do in free agency? The other big one is the Matty Beniers contract, because you think about what that contract would have looked like the year ago this time, you're thinking at least, what, eight, nine, given that he's a 19, 20-year-old top six center, two-way ability, face of your franchise, can anchor you for years to come. Whereas if you look at what that contract would be now, if you're the Kraken, you want to get a long-term deal done, because like, you now control the terms of that. And so these are the things that they're going to be thinking about, in addition to, again, what's going on with this UFA class that they've got to worry about. Who do you keep? Who do you move on from? Who do you think maybe makes it to free agency that can help you out, in addition to like maybe what teams you're going to be cash strapped? Because look, we all see every year there's at least one or two examples of teams that have gone through some sort of cash strap situation, and another team takes advantage, and then you look back and go, how did this happen? It's because there's always someone keeping an eye on what everyone's doing.
Yeah, the Beniers thing is interesting, and you know, I think the Seattle Kraken thing in general is interesting, especially because they actually, you know, if they decided to make moves in a certain way over the course of the next month and a half, it does feel like they have a lot to sell between Eberle and Schultz and company. Do you have any sense of, do you have any expectations for what to expect from the Kraken between now and March 8th?
If they're still in the hunt, one would think they're going to try to retain those players. But if it gets to a point where, let's say, they're out of it by more than 7 or 8 points, then you would think that they would start exploring possibilities. But even, again, for that to happen, it would be one of those, they would have to feel they're out of it. And, like, that's just kind of been the thing with this team really since December, is, like, sure, they've lost games, but for the most part, they've been able to not only win games, but really stay in this conversation, especially in a Western Conference, which, like, as we've been talking about on this program all season, who knows what you're going to get? Like, who would have thought a month and a half ago, we're asking the question, what's going to happen to the LA Kings?
Yeah.
Like, will they make the playoffs? Because, again, just a month and a half ago, the Kings were winning games. They were doing everything you need them to do. Like, they were looking like that team that was going to break that stretch of getting out of the first round. And now it's like, never mind getting out of the first round, will the Kings make it? And so if you're the Kraken, knowing how much the landscape can really and truly change, you're trying to see what this team can do, with the idea that if they're still around at the deadline, either in a position or within a couple points, it looks like they'd be in a position to buy, but only if they feel the price is worth it, because that's the other thing about the Kraken. I mean, really, you're seeing a lot of teams. It's about draft capital, and do they want to give things up, especially when, for the 3 years they've been around, the Kraken's farm system, with what they've done already, it's something that you can see it start to materialize.
We've done a lot of awards talk on this show and in this city in general because there's so many Canucks contending for major awards. But I wanted to bring up a name for the Selkie. We were talking about it on the show yesterday. As you mentioned, his team has won 16 in a row. Connor McDavid, we think of him as the, you know, scoring whiz of the NHL. Is he good enough defensively at this point that he should be in the Selkie conversation as well?
It's a fascinating conversation for sure, but it seems like for him to be in the Selkie, it's possibly about seeing more of it over time, because it's not to say that you don't expect star players like McDavid or Nathan MacKinnon to be good defensively. They're typically good at a lot of different things, but it's sort of one of those like, oh yes, they're good at this. Whereas if you think about the players who are traditionally up for the Selkie, again, like let's say Alexander Barkov, Ryan O'Reilly, Sean Couturier, players such as that, Mark Stone is another one. Like, their two-way presence is something that they have had for years and years and years and years. It's not sort of this, like, okay, they have this one season, and then, okay, they're going to win the Selkie. It's been sort of a case that they built. Not to say that McDavid couldn't win it this season, but it is to say that seeing more of that and seeing that be consistently part of his game, that's something that can help, just because we saw it until his injury with Jack Eichel. You look at Jack Eichel's underlying numbers, especially this season. Jack Eichel was playing like one of the most complete centers in the league. It wasn't just so much what he was doing in 5-on-5 in the O-zone or what he was doing in the power play, but when you look at the Golden Knights penalty kill, Jack Eichel was an effective part of that. But again, like, it takes time to get to that point. And if you're going to continue to see that from Connor McDavid, where he's going to be that sort of real two-way threat, then yes, over time, you would think his name is going to pop up in the Selkie conversation more and more and more.
With what you're seeing from the Vancouver Canucks, right? Like, just thinking about this team from, you know, an outside perspective, but not very far outside, right? It's still on the West Coast. How serious are you taking Vancouver's chances of contending in a meaningful way come this spring?
Extremely.
Mm-hmm.
And extremely, just because, again, let's just take the recent history of the Western Conference. The Dallas Stars in a year went from a team that struggled to score in the first round to they're in the Western Conference. The Golden Knights went from, and maybe that's not the best example, but they went from in the playoffs to out of the playoffs to winning everything under the sun. The Oilers went from conference finalists to getting knocked out in the second round. This is all to say, oh, and another one, again, maybe not the best example, but the Wild were consistently in the playoffs, and now we're looking at them wondering, is this the year that streak ends? And the same thing with Nashville. Nashville made it, what, 9-10 straight years? Last year they missed it. So this is all to say that there's definitely enough evidence to show that anything can happen in this conference, but in terms of their legitimacy as a contender, you would have to take it seriously, just because at what point have the Canucks faltered this year? There hasn't been this 5-6-game losing streak that you say, okay, here are the problems. You look at what they've done. It's not like you say, oh, they're a bad team on the road. No, they've won 15 games on the road. In fact, they're arguably the best road team, Denver, the Bruins, or the Panthers in the NHL. It's not like winning at home has been an issue. They've won 18 games at home. Again, they're getting the defensive structure. They're getting the goals. They're getting the goaltending. It's not to say that everything's always going to go perfect, but at this point, it seems like we haven't really seen much to say, okay, can you really question it? It's not, let's say, like the Winnipeg Jets, where this time last year, we were saying things about the Jets that we're saying now, which is they're complete. They can do X, they can do Y, they can do Z. But then from February 1st on, we saw a totally different team and one that struggled to get into the playoffs. So unless something like that happens with the Canucks, you would think their legitimacy is something that would have to be taken seriously, especially when you look at the West right now. Colorado, Dallas, Vegas, Edmonton, the way it's playing, those are the teams that you look at as the Cup contenders. And then you think about the Canucks. They're in that conversation. The Jets are in that conversation. So, again, that's six teams right there.
Just before we let you go, Ryan, I know last week up at ESPN, you had a really interesting piece looking at how NHL teams choose their captains and to make that decision. And, you know, you kind of centered it around Quinn Hughes becoming the Canucks captain and the process the team went through making that decision. What was your kind of main takeaway about, you know, Hughes as captain and, again, the process that the team used to decide on him as the captain?
Oh, I wish you'd asked me this question earlier because we could have had a fun discussion. As it relates to Quinn Hughes, and we'll start with the first part, it was fascinating to hear what Rick Tocchet said about sort of what do you look for, especially considering Tocchet himself had not only been a captain, but he's worn the A. He's been part of a captaincy search. Like, this is something that it's a very personal topic because, like, he's been through it. And to hear him talk about just sort of what he wanted to see from players in that situation, what JT Miller said about what he noticed, again, it was watching Quinn Hughes not only perform well on the ice, but it was sort of seeing how did he take a more aggressive role in terms of leadership and being vocal with his teammates in difficult situations last season when, hey, look, as we know, it was a difficult year for the Canucks, but it seems like unless you are in Vancouver, people kind of forget, hey, those 36 games Rick Tocchet was in charge, they won 20-36, but again, it came with that context of, like, they could win a game, but Tocchet would still say, I didn't like X, Y, or Z. So to think about everything he was managing while still picking a captain was interesting. In terms of, like, how it's done, it really is that multiple-point conversation of, one, why do captains always end up being the best players, your top six, your top four, and it's because they're on the ice more. Number two, it's who does have the final say, because sometimes you hear, like, okay, was this person the best choice because they think it's about long-term impact? Do they think it was the best choice because they're the best player? Do they think it was the best choice because it was of a marketing decision, which is something people have alluded to? And then it seems the third part is just how much do players really have a say? Just because, like, from talking to Quinn Hughes, and this didn't get to the story because we don't have so much space, like, I'd ask him, like, hey, when you were in Michigan, how did this work? And he was just like, this is the coach's decision. Why would you let a 17, 18, 19-year-old freshman have a say in something like this, which is the complete opposite of what you see in other collegiate sports where players are allowed to have a vote. So those would probably be the big takeaways from something like that in terms of how this whole thing works.
Ryan, appreciate the time as always, man. Let's hope the All-Star game is enjoyable this go-around.
Considering it's on a certain network, yes, let's hope.
Hey, we're in the same boat.
Sure, it'll be a good time.
We're in the same boat. Sure, what am I saying? It's going to be must-watch TV, of course. How dare I
can't miss it.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me. Take care.
Yes, absolutely, everyone. Make sure you tune in for the unfailingly entertaining and compelling All-Star festivities on Sportsnet.
Every time. It delivers every time.
Yes, absolutely. I will say, this is not, you know, being a company man, I am very curious. I find the skills competition more interesting usually anyways than the game just because it's different. Like, the game, as you say, you can tell this is not hockey. It's like, it's supposed to be hockey, but it's not hockey. At least the skills competition isn't trying to be hockey. It's trying to be its own thing. So I think it's inherently more entertaining and compelling. I think there could be some real juice to it this year. I'm excited to see. I like that it's the consistent participants. They got some really big names in it. The money's at stake. I have high hopes. I am genuinely interested to watch it.
The key is, like, the key is, in my opinion, is that the All-Star game and All-Star festivities become interesting the moment one single person
cares
for a second.
Yeah.
And then everyone cares because these are hyper-competitive people. And the fact that McDavid designed it, I think, like, hopefully he goes in and is like, I'm going to win. Because if he does, everyone's going to, like, that's going to create a whole dynamic, you know? So hopefully giving players a little bit of a stake in the entertainment product will have impact. Because that's our only hope.
Yes, that's the key. And that's the only way, like, people talk about the NBA All-Star game getting good in, you know, in crunch time. And that happens occasionally. Not as often as people think, I don't think. And even then, it's because there's competitive guys going at it, right? And they start to care a little
bit. And a legacy of it. Like, you know, some All-Star game moments have been fun, right?
Yep.
Like, I mean, Garrett tells the story of Wayne Gretzky in the third period going ham in the All-Star game in 1982. You have Dominic Hasek pitching a shutout, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Owen Nolan goes and does the points his
Yeah,
top calls corner
a shot.
Goal.
Yep.
And like honestly, I remember the sequence at the All-Star game in Ottawa, which was the one where like Sidney Crosby's injury got announced. But like it was Hossa versus Carlson, and like one of the team that Hossa was on, which must have been the Western Conference, had like just sort of staged a comeback, and there was like a loose puck battle. And in a tie game late in the third, and they both kind of actually
tried
for it, and Hossa won the battle and set up a goal. And it was like, it wasn't a great game or anything, but there was one moment that actually was that actually mattered, that actually was cool. So you know, you get it sometimes,
woo!
But it takes
one moment. We did it.
Hey, I'm talking about it 12 years later. Because it's like one of the few moments in an All-Star game. And look, the John Scott moment was good.
Yep.
That was
a real
hilarious
thing. And if we're talking about memorable All-Star moments, that's right there.
Who was the Canuck representative on John Scott's winning 3-on-3 tournament team?
I have no idea. Who was it?
Daniel Sedin.
Very good.
Yeah, there you go. There's
I
your
thought
little
it was
going to
be
Canucks
someone
All-Star
like
trivia.
Super obscure and
didn't even let me answer.
And random.
Why,
did
you
know?
Yeah.
No. Why did you know?
Dom's like, Mark Sanchez.
Because you love All-Star? What do you love?
There's nothing else on.
You love All-Star because there's nothing else on.
Yeah.
All right. What a commentary.
No, actually, I always do make a point of, like, watching, even though, like, NHL All-Star games frustrate me to no end.
Yeah, it's not great. I would say, in general, the skills competition in every sport is better than the game. Like,
except for baseball.
No,
the
home run
derby
is
sick.
Are you kidding me?
I've grown tired of
the home run derby is way better than the All-Star game. The All-Star game's fine in baseball. But baseball doesn't lend itself to, like, an All-Star game format.
I'd say it does more than any other.
It's more competitive, but it's not like, oh, they're going to try to do cool things out there. You know what I mean?
Oh, I see.
So it's like,
mean.
Whatever. But the home run derby is amazing. Slam dunk competition, three-point contest, better than the game. Anyways, we'll go to break. Final segment of
Slam
the show.
Slam dunk contest is not better than the game.
It used to be.
Yeah.
And it still can be.
Hasn't been
from
since
time to time.
Toronto.
Yeah, no.
That was like, probably the last classic one.
Kobe
yeah.
under the legs, Vince Carter, that was cool.
Aaron Gordon,
that was good.
The Zach LaVine, Aaron Gordon one was awesome. You guys are sleeping on Jason Richardson.
That was sick.
Hey, Rich, yeah.
He was awesome.
I still
are you
think,
kidding me?
I still think Stromile Swift got robbed.
I mean, yeah.
He botched his dunks. Oh, I was so excited that he was in it, too. He blew it.
Young Jamie just doing, like, the Birdman symbol at his TV.
Absolutely. Damon Jones was his teammate passing him the ball there, and they screwed it up. Anyways, should we talk about this more?
No.
All right, we're going to break. Send your text in. Give us something to talk about other than the 2001 slam dunk contest that Stromile Swift failed to win in the final segment
or don't.
Of Canucks Talk here. Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strands here live. From the Kintech Studio. I don't know if we've ever gotten to this part of it. I like that. A little saxophone getting in there. That's fun. We are live from the Kintech Studio.
Wrong type of saxophone, though.
Yes, not squirrel.
Dun, 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 dun,
650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. The iconic Coors Light Chill Train is heading to Las Vegas for the big game, and it just made a stop in Vancouver, leaving behind a trail of epic prizes. On February 1st and 2nd from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m., look for its frozen tracks at Robson Square for a chance to win instant prizes that deliver big game day chill or the ultimate grand prize, a trip to next year's big game event. Learn more at CoorsLight.ca/thechilltrain. Into the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line. Some good text coming in throughout the course of the show. This one from Denis from Langley says, hey, Drance, couldn't they technically afford two big pieces just by getting rid of Kuzmenko's full 5.5, assuming that both acquired players are 50% retained. Now, the retention thing is interesting because, yes, obviously that opens up a whole bunch of different possibilities, but we're also talking about how careful the Canucks have to be with what they send out in any potential trade. And if you're asking teams to retain not just a little bit, but the full 50%, that increases the ask a lot, commensurately, right?
I mean, there's the point of looking at the fundamentals like this, right? And casting a slightly wider net than I'm actually even comfortable with, right? Like, if you go read the trade tiers part two piece that we have up at The Athletic, like, there's a lot of players that I'd say 90% likely to be here past the deadline. But that 10%, that concept of optionality, I think matters, right? And this comes back to the approach that we take to a lot of things, right? Like how, even though after the season, the Canucks, Patrick Alvin said, we will not exercise a buyout, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember, like, I'm sure there was something.
We don't intend, I believe, was the wording.
But for most people, that was like, okay, the Canucks aren't going to exercise a buyout. On our show, though, we were like, yeah.
You never know.
You never know. Moment the window opens, like, buyout. Boom.
Let's do it.
That was
here we go.
That was so funny. That was such good theater.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the same thing to consider. So there are possibilities to get two big rental pieces on the books with only one subtraction. It's not necessarily the likeliest outcome. It means that you're paying more in terms of future assets, right? The other thing to consider is it's a lot harder to get people to retain if you're pursuing a multi-year piece.
Yes.
Which I remain convinced is like so clearly what this team should do based on their positioning that there's no way they're not considering it.
Yeah, the rental retention is always interesting to me because you want something back for the money you're retaining, obviously, right? But
yeah,
it's also not as if the team selling the rental is desperate for that cap space to go out and do something necessarily. There might be a little bit of utility to it, right?
Well, and don't forget the actual cash part.
That's the thing.
The prorated cash part is
yeah,
huge part of
it. That's really what you're paying for at that point. Because it's not as if the selling team is going to turn around and, you know, do something big with that cap space for the remainder of the year. So you're right. I mean, with a rental, it doesn't necessarily have to be prohibitively expensive to get that retention, but you do pay an extra premium for it at some point. And then once you start talking about a multi-year deal, then it can get really, really expensive because you can't retain just for a year, right?
No.
You're retaining for every year left on the deal.
So we're just talking like overall optionality. I think it makes sense to cast a wide net, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there are scenarios where you could subtract just one big salaried player from the roster and make multiple ads.
Yeah, it's a possibility. And I guess it's good. It's a good point to keep in mind, right? As like one thing we've stressed or I've tried to stress is, you know, even the whole thing with talking about Zadorov to me is not evidence of any like dissatisfaction with the team and Zadorov. It's evidence of they're willing to be creative. They're willing to try. They're willing to keep a lot of different things on the table if it means improving the team and paying more to get a team to retain. Probably one of those options. Maybe not option number one, but it's at least something that's out there and that they could consider doing.
Well, and this step, I mean, the way that this season has played out, it's been such a dream that it can almost become like easy to ignore how hard it is to take that final step.
Mm.
You know, like this moment in some ways is the trickiest one. Now, there have been a lot of big bets that have hit in major ways. I'm not trying to downplay what has been done to this point, but it's one thing to upgrade like a blue line that was really inept. Now, to do it as quickly as they've done still deserves a huge like round of applause. But the precision, like the surgical precision now required to be like, okay, where do we want to upgrade? And it's like such a narrow band. It's like, man, if we could upgrade second pair RD,
yeah,
and that moves Myers a little bit further down the lineup, right? What is the marginal value of that to us in games that we're leading in April against an elite side, right? Relative to having four lefties or playing Ian Cole on the right side with Zadorov on the third pair. What's the marginal value, right? And how much are we willing to pay for that? And how much that we pay for that is worth taking out of sort of the artillery, right? Like out of the chest of weaponry that we have for the next 2-3 seasons, right? That's and then up front, it's the same thing. It's like, I'm sure this team wants to be bigger. I'm sure they'd love another net front guy for the power play. How do you prioritize, right? Because it's going to cost something down the line or what have you. Like there's going to be a material cost to it. You know, it's a tough thing to weigh. And again, the Rutherford MO has typically been just land the most impactful guy, right? The fit stuff can be accomplished with depth pieces, right? Like I'd be shocked if the Canucks paid for like the right-handed defense upgrade. You know, like if there's a huge bidding war for Tanev, is the marginal upgrade that significant? You know, I feel like that's something where the club might try to address with depth, unless you're getting a star guy, like unless you're talking Brett Pesce or something. But the forward thing, the upgrading the push in the top six, to me, that's the higher leverage one. And, you know, that's where I could see the Canucks paying, even if the fit's not like perfect, just like that one more star guy.
Yeah, that's the driver.
Driver, that's the right word. Like one more guy to, and it's really one more guy to help. Like what you're trying to bring in is one more guy to help Pettersson and Miller, you know, whether it's been Phil DiGiuseppe or Pugh Suter's been a really nice fit there since they've tried him. And Pettersson's been playing with Kuzmenko and Mikheyev, both who've gone quiet, right? Some of the best hockey we saw this season was when Pettersson's quality of teammate really amped up. Like what you're really looking for is just a little bit of help for Miller and Pettersson in terms of helping them win really tough matchups. Because again, you look at the playoffs and it's like, you're going to have these head-to-head MacKinnon minutes, right? You're going to have these head-to-head Scheifele-Ehlers-Vilardi minutes. You're going to have these head-to-head
Eichel
minutes, which, you know, and that matchup was really tough. Like Vancouver lost that matchup as cleanly as you can in those teams' first head-to-head matchup. McDavid, right? Like we're not talking Tuesday night against the San Jose Sharks here, right? Like once you get to April, and this is where it's really, really difficult. Those small changes that you have to make now that you hope work, right? And as Rutherford said, they can work and it cannot matter, right? You can have a puck bounce off someone's face and be caught by Brandon Ayuk for some reason. Like, you know. There's a lot of luck.
Would be surprising too in the NHL playoffs.
Would be
out of
stunner.
Nowhere.
And it's like, and it eliminates the Red Wings, City of Detroit. It's like, what?
How is this possible?
The point being, this is in some ways one of the most complicated phases. Which is to take nothing away from how impressively the Canucks have turned this around.
And I think thinking about it in terms of those minutes is really instructive. Like, that's really what we're talking about here. Because we're not, you know, you can go out and you can add some depth to your bottom six, but the Canucks' bottom six is performing exceptionally well, right? As you were saying, like, they've been a huge driver of this streak of really impressive underlying performances.
That's not what the Canucks need.
Right.
Canucks. That's not what the Canucks need to upgrade.
But thinking about it in terms of, okay, when you're in these specific situations in these really hard minutes in the playoffs, right, where the intensity amps up and there's elite players on the other side, who do you feel comfortable putting out there? And this text came in earlier in the show, unsigned, says, guys, I feel like this isn't talked about enough. If the team moves off Kuzmenko to get another top six forward, isn't this team still short a top six forward? And he also says, even with Kuzmenko's struggles, there's still more top six upside, and you have to feel better about him than you do somebody like a PD. Right? The thing is, as much as Kuzmenko is, you know, skating with Elias Pettersson in line rushes right now and, you know, scored 39 goals last year, like, he's not really a top six forward for this team right now. We've talked so much about where his ice time is, and his ice time has been bottom six level for most of the season, even in games and in stretches where he has skated with Pettersson in line rushes. And if that's the case in the regular season, you know, I don't think he's all of a sudden going to become a legitimate top 6 minutes guy once the playoffs roll around. And to the comparison with Phil DiGiuseppe, I mean, I don't know. Like, if it was, you know, tie game in the third period in a series against the Golden Knights, who do you think Tocchet's more likely to put out there? Phil DiGiuseppe or Andre Kuzmenko?
It's Phil DiGiuseppe. It's not even a question.
Right? And I mean, that's really what we're talking here, is finding those players that when Eichel and Mark Stone do come over the boards, Tocchet can look down the bench and feel at least comfortable, right? Okay, hey, I can put this guy out there and I'm not scared to death of it, right? And I think that's what, more than offensive production or anything like that, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about replacing Andre Kuzmenko. Now, I will say the point of could they actually be short two top six forwards? I mean, we're talking about multiple ads here, and we're kind of naturally talking about, well, you know, a forward and a defenseman. I don't know. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that they could go for two forwards, right? When we, you know, like Pugh Suter has been excellent. He's been a really good fit. But if you have to bump him down to your bottom six, there's no problem with that.
No.
Right? So I think when we talk about two moves, potentially, yeah, it could be a forward and a defenseman, but I could see a world where it's two forwards
yeah.
as well. Right?
For sure.
Move some guys down, slot some guys down farther down in the lineup. If you're bringing in the right type of players, that could work.
Well, I also think it's not the worst idea for the club to double down. Like, if the most impactful guy available, right? Now, bring up Brett Pesce just because Brett Pesce rocks mm-hmm. and is the sort of rare piece.
He is sick.
He's sick.
Yeah.
He's the sort of rare piece that I think could move the needle. Like, the thing that is most imposing about this team right now,
mm-hmm.
right? The thing that's driven their ludicrous January, their emergence as a team that I'm side-eyeing as a potential bona fide elite NHL side, it's not the offense.
Mm.
Like, the biggest change in what the Canucks are doing is their defense over the course of the last month has gone from good to outrageously good. I don't always think it's the wrong call to just double down on
to
what
lean
you do
into
well.
What you're awesome at.
Like, you know, if you're rolling into the playoffs and you're rolling Hughes, Hronek, Soucy, Pesce, Cole Myers, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And not that that's sufficient to explain defensive play, but it's also about rolling Miller, Pettersson, Bluger, Suter down the middle of the ice, right? Then, yeah, are you hoping to just come out even at the top of the lineup
mm-hmm.
in some matchups? For sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you're hoping that Garland and Hoglander can outscore the opposition's
bottom six,
which, yeah. guess what? Good bet.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't hate that, especially when you've got Thatcher Demko, because that's, again, the area where, look at the other Pacific Division teams, I think you feel very comfortable.
Well, and the one thing about that, let's say they did try, okay, this is going to be our identity. We're going to double down on that by going after the defender rather than the forward. The thing with the Canucks is they do have the guys that can kind of score against the run of play. You know what I mean? Like, you mm-hmm. still, you're not petrified of your offense drying up in that scenario, because Pettersson can break the game open. Miller can break the game open. You have the power play, right? Like, I think you can.
I still want a more sustainable brand of offense.
Sure. But at least we've seen this team can buck the trend of the percentages a
for
little
sure,
bit.
For
you
sure.
know what I mean? So you can kind of lean into that as your identity.
They can convert efficiently, but it's just that's a knife's edge way to live.
Oh, 100%.
But, you know, I think it's important to note, like, I'm going to come back to the Lions here because of your great Dan Campbell segment from yes, but, you know, the way that they upgraded their run game. They were, like, not content to just be like, oh, we're fine. We're going to be great.
Yeah, we're going to be wicked at the run. Well, and just the way you just listed it there, right? Hughes, Hronek, Soucy, blank, Cole Myers. With the way Myers has played this year, Ian Cole's track record and his pedigree in the Stanley Cup and all that, like, that's an incredible third pair to have going into the playoffs. Like, that is a really, really good position
Huge
to be
luxury.
In. And I understand why. And again, that's why, you know, the Chris Tanev thing, even though you look at the blue line, you can say, oh, well, maybe you don't tinker with it. You know, you have these big guys. But if you have the possibility of sending those pairings out, I absolutely understand why the team would be very, very curious about it. Like, that's really impressive.
Can I scroll this and read a text?
Please do.
It's a negative bit of feedback, but I'm just stunned that this brand of human being exists and want to share it with the world. There's an All-Star Game Hardo in our text.
I know. He was, like, outraged that we were trashing the All-Star Game.
Basically accused us and the station of not being
unpatriotic.
Not being Canadians or hockey fans, because every Canadian and hockey fan will turn on the All-Star Game. Good news to our benefactors.
Does this person realize that NHL players would rather go to Cancun like, than an All-Star game?
I didn't respond because I was like, I'm not going to be mean. But it's like, you realize it's for children, right?
This
like,
person,
we can all, even if we're watching for it, we all know what the score is. It's for children.
This person then notes that it's too bad that our former rival station, which, you know, I think both of us worked for at one point, Jamie.
I did not.
You no, didn't?
No. I did. You and I did.
You and I did. Okay. Yeah. Too bad they're gone. Because I would not have to be insulted as a 50-year-plus Canuck fan by the fact that the All-Star game is pretty meh.
But he did. He did instead of he was obviously a really devoted 1040 guy because he said 1410 instead of 1040.
That is real devotion.
So he really was really committed to the brand. Yeah, that was a wild text. Look, that was an absolutely wild
text. The NHL All-Star game is the only one of the four where being named an All-Star is an inconvenience rather than an honor.
That's not true.
Yes, it is.
No, I'm sure. Do you think guys go to the Pro Bowl after the season? Do you think guys are excited?
How many guys do you see campaigning to be Pro Bowlers? You know why? Because it counts toward their contract, their
bonuses.
That's
a different thing then.
Yeah, but this is what I'm talking about. The All-Star game in the NHL is so pointless for players. It makes no difference to them.
Dumb. I mostly agree. I don't 100% agree. I think you're going a little too far. But I just want to talk about the idea of being a hockey hardo for the All-Star game. I really want to focus on the preposterous silliness of that. Like, if you are offended that someone has less than 100% interest, and if you assume that all Canadians are going to tune in to watch the All-Star game.
That's amazing.
If a quarter as many Canadians watch that as watched some of the NFL football broadcasts over the last 2 weeks, I will be shocked. Like, chill, man. Chill. I know hockey fans love to do the, like, chest-thumping thing in this country.
I've never heard it, the All-Star game, tied to, like, Canadian patriotism.
No!
That's a new one for me.
Yeah, this isn't the Olympics.
That famous moment where all of Canada stops and comes together to watch the All-Star game.
And you know what? You know what? It's especially funny because most Canadians are like very focused on their teams as opposed to being like wider NHL fans.
Yeah.
You know, like that's my experience anyway, anecdotally. But yeah, All-Star game hardo. Give your head a shake. I love it.
Yeah. That was a special, special text. Hey, it's the bye week. It's the All-Star break. It's the perfect time for absolutely wild texts like that one to come in. So do you think we're doing the trades? The trades tomorrow?
You know, the actual Canadian anthem goes, "We stand on guard for the NHL All-Star game."
A part of our heritage, the NHL All-Star game. Nothing more famous than that. When you think of Canada, you think the All-Star game.
That's why when you look at our money, it's got the All-Star game on it.
Are we doing the trade thing tomorrow? There was tons that came in.
Yeah, we're doing the trade
tomorrow. Very special edition of Canucks Talk. Of course, we'll have the crossover and our guy, Jason Buchla, on the show as well as the All-Star break continues here on Sportsnet 650.